In verse 6, let's do a prayer. Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kritam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanusankatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadvarshinim. Verse 6. Natad Vasayate Suryaha Natad Vasayate Suryaha Nashashanko Napavakaha Nashashanko Napavakaha Yadgatva Nani Bharatante Yadgatva Nani Bharatante Taddhama Paramamama Taddhama Paramamama Na Tat Bhasayate Suryaha Na Shashankaha Napavakaha Yat Gatwa Na Nivaratante Tad Dhamma Paramamama. In the previous verse ends with those amudaha, those who, for whom there is no longer any delusion, any ajnanam, tad amudaha, gachanti, they go to that pada, tad padam, which is avyayam, which is immutable, that padam which is free from time and space, that pada, that abode, which is Brahman, they go to that. So then, he's now going to talk about that pada. So he says, Natad bhasyate suryaha. That pada, that dhamma, as we'll see now, they're using the word dhamma. Remember I talked last week about the use of this word abode or place? Because we think about going to heaven, going to these heaven worlds. We go to that place. We have in our mind going, when we talk about liberation or freedom or salvation, to go into a heavenly world, or going to a heaven. So that pada, we're keeping that word, that pada, that sacred abode, that sacred place. We keep the word, and now we're going to deal with the word a little differently. So he says, that pada, in this case, that this pada, which is avyaya, means immutable, free from any type of change or modification. It never changes from its own nature. So he says, now, Natad bhasyate suriha, that pada, that dhamma, that place, which the sun can't illumine, na bhasyate suriha. Surya is the sun, na bhasyate. The sun can't make it shine. In Sanskrit, this word bha or bhas means for something to become visible. So the sun can't make this shine. Right? It can't make it become visible. So in English, we don't say it like that. We say the sun can't light it up. Okay? So, natad bhasyate suriha. Na shashankaha, the moon can't light it up. Na pavakaha, agni, the fire. Fire also can't light it up. So this abode, this dhamma, which the sun or the moon or even the agni, the three luminaries that we have, you know, the sun, the moon, and the agni, and the fire, they can't light it up. So this pada, then he says, yad gatva, having gone to which, na nivartante, there is no return. Having gone to which, they can't come, they can't return. Yad gatva, having gone to which, na nivartante, they don't come back. Tad dhamma, that abode, tad dhamma, is paramam mama. That is my abode, which is paramam. That mama means that is my abode, Krishna talking. That is my abode, which is parama. Parama means supreme. Supreme means desha kala vastu aparichedaha. That abode which is not limited by space, desha, by kala, by time, by vastu, by any type of objectivity, that abode which is just pure conscious being, pure Satchitananda, that abode which the sun can't illumine, the luminaries, the moon can't illumine, the Agni, the fire can't illumine, and having gone to which there is no return, that abode is my Parama abode. So here, when we're talking about going to and not being able to return from, any time that we go to a place, we can return, or we can continue on. When we're talking about going, this word going, we're moving, we're within duality, we're going from point A to point B. And so here when we're talking about going to point A and point B, but once we get there, there's no coming back, what type of return is that? You know, what type of going is that if we can't come back from it? And also, what do we mean by going to a place that cannot be illumined? In other words, if we remove all of the luminaries don't light it up. The sun doesn't light up this place. The moon won't light up this place. Fire won't light up this place. You can see your flashlights won't light up this place. This thing is not something, this place of going is not something that can be illumined in the world. If it can't be illumined by the luminaries, then maybe this place is not an object that can be illumined. This is not an object that can be illumined. The sun can't illumine it. The moon can't illumine it. No luminary can illumine it. And it's not a thing to be illumined. Right? So this thing is not available to be illumined. And having gone to it, there's no return. So that place, Bhagavan says, that place is my paramam abode. In fact, that place is me. That place is me. The conscious being that I am illumines the sun. It illumines the moon. It illumines the luminaries. It illumines the fire. The fire doesn't illumine it. In fact, consciousness is the ultimate luminary. It's because of conscious being. And if you think, sometimes they use this example. If we use the example like, say, for instance, in this room, this lamp. This lamp is the luminary in this room. Okay? So because of the lamp, I can see this table. Because of the lamp, I can see everything else. So the lamp, in a sense, is an intermediary. The lamp is required for me to see these things that themselves are not luminous. But the lamp itself doesn't require a luminary, because it is the luminary. All of these other things require a luminary. The lamp doesn't, because it itself is the light. It doesn't need another light to light up itself. That's fine, and that works very well for the relationship we have within duality. But in fact, if my eyes are blind, this light is not functioning for me. Right? This light requires my eyes in order for its light to be lit up. Right? My eyes light up this light. See that? Without my eyes, this light is not there. It's not doing its function. So my eyes are another level of luminary, which is necessary for me to see that light. And that light is necessary for me to see all of this. But then my eyes require my mind to light it up. If my eyes aren't being used by my mind, then these eyes are not functioning. They might be here, but if my mind isn't using them, say I'm daydreaming, or my mind is asleep, then these eyes are not functioning to light up this light, which lights up all of this. And so like that, I can go inward again. My mind itself is lit up. Without my mind being lit up, for the vrittis to be known, right? These vrittis that use the eyes to see the light, to see the objects in the world, for this vritti that is gained, the vritti that is gained through my sense perception, that vritti itself must be lit up. It must be known. And so the conscious being which lights up the mind, which lights up the eyes, which lights up the light, which lights up the room, that conscious being itself isn't lit up by the mind or by the eyes or by the luminaries, or by the objects. Conscious being is not an object in the world to be lit up, but conscious being is the self because of which everything is lit up. And so here, when we say that Dhamma, Bhagavan says, that Dhamma is my supreme abode. That is who I am. That light, lighting up, which lights everything else up, itself is not lit, itself is not lit up. So that self, how can I go to that self? Because having gone to this self, there is no return. But having gone to this self, there is no return. Because actually there's no going. There's only a going in terms of knowledge, in terms of removing ignorance. And having removed the ignorance, there is no return. Shankara gives the example of, say if I have a pot, and in the pot is some akasha, in the gutta, in the pot there's some akasha, there is some space, pot space. What happens when I realize that the space is free of the pot? The space is free of the pot. The pot space itself is an illusion. There is no pot space. The pot exists in space. There is no pot space. If I move like this, the pot like this, from this side to this side, I'm not tearing I'm leaving a hole in the space. Right? So the space is absolutely free of the pot. So what happens when I recognize the relationship of space to the pot? I can't go back to the pot space. Right? Once I've realized the nature of the space in reference to the pot, I can't get back to the pot space because there never was pot space. And in that way, once I've recognized the nature of my being, I can't go back. I can't go back to the jiva. I can't go back from the relationship myself as the Atma to myself as this body. See, I travel as a jiva. I'm a limited jiva, different from you, different from you, different from you. I'm, as we'll see in this next verse, I'm a jiva transmigrating in the world. So now this jiva needs to reach Brahman. This jiva that's transmigrating in the world, taking birth after birth after birth, this jiva needs to reach moksha, needs to gain moksha, needs to reach Brahman. And so now, how am I going to reach Brahman? Because in reality, I am Brahman. So how can I reach Brahman? The only way I can reach Brahman is to remove the ajnanam, to remove the ignorance that makes me think to falsely identify myself with this body, mind, sense organs. When that identification is broken, then I am Brahman. Now, how am I going to return to that previous condition? How am I going to go back? Because to go back, I have to regain my ignorance. Right? I would have to become ignorant again. And so, if I in the Vedanta, there's a huge and very important discussion about the very unusual nature of ajnanam, of ignorance. Because we say that this ignorance, which we all suffer from, right? And even in terms of self-knowledge, we all suffer from. I don't know myself. I'm a conscious being, but I don't know what this conscious being is. That's the ignorance. I have what we call the samanya jnanam, this general knowledge of myself, where I say, I exist, I am a conscious being. But that's all I know. I'm a conscious being. I have no idea if it's the consciousness is a product of this body, or the consciousness that I am, what it is in relationship to you or in relationship to God, I have no idea. If the consciousness transmigrates or not, I hope it does, but I have no idea really. All I know is I'm a conscious being, and I know I exist, I am. But I don't know what the amness, what the cause of the amness is. If the amness is a byproduct of this body, if my being is different from your being, if amness comes into is something that is produced and then goes out of production, has actual birth, like come into being and go out of being, I have no idea. All I know is I am, I exist. That's what we call the general knowledge that all beings have. Even an animal, they might not say it. They might not have the capacity to say I am and I exist, but that is their experience. I am, I'm a little conscious, you know, being. You don't have to say anything about it, it's just the fact of it. And they're saying it from the experiencing it from the standpoint of their upadhi. What they don't know, and what we don't know until we do, is that this amness, this conscious being that I am, is one without a second. That my being, in fact, is the very self of the entire creation. No, 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 no. It's not that the being that I am is unknown. The freedom of myself is unknown. The oneness of myself, the non-dual nature of myself, that this me is something that is this paramam dhamma, the supreme abode, the self that is really like space in the sense of not contained at all. Space is not contained at all. It's relative. But in the universe, space is the closest that we can come. Space, air, fire, water, earth. Space is the most subtle. And so space is the one that pervades absolutely everything. Everything is in space, but space is not in anything. Space is in and through everything, but not contained. So similarly, your being is in and through everything, it is not contained. From the standpoint of the creation, from my own standpoint, just the conscious being that I am, I'm not in and through anything. I am, that's all. I am. There's nothing that is not me. There's nothing separate from me. That I don't know. That takes a lot of viveka, that takes a lot of teaching to really wake up to that. But what happens when I do wake up to that? What happens is that the ahankara, the I notion, the I am, this body, mind, sense, organs, I am this mind, I am these feelings, that ahankara is transferred from the body, mind, sense, organs. It transfers from all of the identification with all of the upadis to me. So think of it like this. Everybody has an I thought. You have so many different I thoughts. I'm thinking this, I'm feeling that, you know, I'm going to the store, you know, I'm feeling tired or I'm feeling energy, I am a friend, I'm an enemy, I'm a teacher, I'm a student, I. The ahankara is continually landing on all of my experiences. And even when you have knowledge, that will continue, but it will continue as mitya. But when the ahankara, when I think, who am I? The I, even now, lands on me. If I'm just sitting here and I'm thinking of myself, where is that I am? Where is it landing? Where does it land? For jnani, once you know, that I lands on me. It lands on Atma. It lands on my being, which is changeless, which is always the same, which is ever present, which is the very one that is present there, the me that is present, without any type of change in all of my experience. That's where it lands. And that one is present no matter what is going on in my mind or what is going on out here in the world. There's no way to go back from that. There's no return from that. Because once that viveka has taken place, then I am. The ahankara, it now becomes the aham. It lands on me, and that's where it stays. If I'm thinking about it, if I'm thinking about myself, it goes to me. The me that, because of viveka, has been differentiated from all of my experiences. And so, when we're doing this meditation, I decided to stop instead of spending the whole time on the meditation because I thought I could talk about it a little bit in class. You have basically, at all times, kind of three experiences, if I can say it like that. One experience is, in the emotional gamut, one experience is the constant of just your own me, your own presence. The me that you've come to know, the Atma that you've come to know. The Atma which, from its own standpoint, is always the same. and is always full and complete as it is. When we even we say these words, your own me, your own self, it is what you are, what you are. It's whole in its own right. It's, you are full in your own right. It's not a fullness of the world. It's a fullness of your own nature. And it's never changing. Then there's the gamut of emotions. The gamut of mental states, emotional states that your mind can enjoy. So I'm going to divide those into two. There's the sukha, the positive emotional states, and all of their variants, all of the loving emotional, loving states, happy states, and then there's all the sad, negative states. So we have the positive states and the negative states. The negative states are like, you know, anger or agitation or fear or hurt or, you know, trauma or whatever they are all those emotional states that you have what we call a nivritti for. We don't want those. And then we have all these positive states that we have what's called a pravritti for. We want these. We like these. And so the whole life in samsara has to do with creating environments for myself where I can have the least amount of negative states of mind and the most amount of positive states. Positive states can just be even relaxing. Relaxing states where all is well with me. I'm not suffering. Those non-suffering states are what I go toward, and I go away from suffering states, okay? Anything, discomfort states. That's just natural. And this is exactly what samsara is, because what makes it samsara is that my well-being is dependent on the universe providing happy situations for me in which I can relax. So that means I require you, O world, and you, O friends and people that are in my life, to be in a way, in such a way, that I can feel happy and loved and whatever it is, whatever the positive state happens to be. And I try to be in that type of circumstance so that I can be happy and be away from all of the negative circumstances so that I won't have to be unhappy, right? So the ananda, the happiness and the happiness and unhappiness is really projected onto the world. This makes me happy, this makes me unhappy. These things change, by the way. The things sometimes that makes me happy at another time, the same thing will make me unhappy. So it's fluctuating. This happiness and sadness of the situation is fluctuating, but I am very much tied into being or creating situations where I can be happy. That's a problem, because I can't control the world in that way. The world doesn't, even if we look at it from the standpoint of Vedanta and the standpoint of karma in this particular loka, the world makes sure, the karma makes sure that you're not going to be successful in having just happy states. Because the karma, as the tradition holds, will create a 50-50 for you. 50% of those states that Bhagavan provides for you as your prarabdha unfolds will be more or less happy. It means I can relax and enjoy myself in that particular situation. And the other 50% will be more or less stressful. Or I can't just relax in the situation. This situation is not conducive to my happiness. So I find the world presenting a whole medley of situations for me that go from the stress, the negative, to the positive, and back and forth, negative, positive, negative, positive. And so if I am projecting ananda, my well-being, onto these happy or so-called happy or conducive or non-conducive states, my life is a roller coaster. Now I'm happy, now I'm sad. Now I'm happy, now I'm sad. Now I'm happy, now I'm sad. And Swamiji will go like this. He started with that happy, sad, happy. Now he'll go, sukha, sukha, sukha means happy. Sukha, sukha, dukkha, 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 sukha, dukkha, 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 sukha. Like that. And so what makes a person a mumukshu is the recognition, really, that this, that I'm on a roller coaster ride and I cannot get off it as long, if that's the truth. If this world is what is responsible for my happiness, some of it gives me happiness, some of it takes it away. If that is the reality, I'm not free, nor can I be free. So what in the end is the solution to this? And the solution, as this, these verses are talking about, is the recognition of a wholeness or an ananda, a fullness that has nothing to do with a situation, has nothing whatsoever to do with whatever situation, whether it be an uncomfortable situation, meant to be uncomfortable, meant to be difficult, or a situation meant to be pleasurable. That ananda, that paramam dhamma, has absolutely nothing to do with it. That's, that dhamma, that abode, is not dependent on situation at all, zero. And so in this world of experience that we have, this world is in continual flux, this body is continual flux, it can be healthy, it can be sick, your mind is continually changing, your sense organs are changing. There is no experience here that's available to you, really, that isn't changing. And so there's no paramam dhamma here, you know. There's nothing that you can count on here to be in any particular way, right? You can't really even count on your mind to be in any particular way. Because as I was saying in the meditation, you know, there are some things in the world that you can change, some things that are conducive to your well-being that you can enjoy, but they're subject to change. There's some things in the world that are not conducive to your well-being that are subject to change. And then there's some things in the world that are not necessarily subject to change. You're stuck with them. There's some things about your body that you can improve. There's some things about your body that you can't improve. There's some illnesses that you're stuck with. There's some limitations that you're stuck with. And there's some good things also.
That you're stuck with.
That you're stuck with. You know, some things you can change in the world. Some things about your body you can change. Some things you can make better. Some things you have to live with. And your mind also. Depending on what your childhood was, what kind of traumas. There are some things in your mind, some tendencies, some ways of being that you're stuck with. You know, there's some things that easily improve. There's some things, there's emotional growth, you know, that make your mind enjoy a lot more shanti. Just from the standpoint of the mind, I'm saying, even without any knowledge. There's some things about the mind, your mind that even with knowledge or without knowledge, with just psychological maturity, that improve, and your mind enjoys much more shanti. And then there's some things in the mind that cause some pain or some discomfort. And you may have to live your whole life handling that type of pain or that type of discomfort. It's just the nature of the beast, so to speak. It's the nature of the creation. It's not as though on any level in the creation that everything is just, you gain knowledge and everything becomes nice. It isn't like that. There is one thing that is nice. There is one thing that is whole. One thing that is free. One thing that is totally, changelessly, indestructible. Changelessly complete. Changelessly whole. Changelessly ananda. And that thing, along with this, dukkha to sukha, in the mind and the different changes that the universe has to provide, along with that, there is one thing that is absolutely whole and complete. And so that is your own being. And so what happens is that your mind, and this is what we call the vairagya, as you gain knowledge, as you gain this viveka, really, clarity, you recognize yourself, the sanctuary for your mind, the sanctuary of your mind, is your own being, which is ever-present, which is the very self of everything, really, and the very self of your mind, and which is whole and complete and changeless, and the mind gains its, it has this in the Bhagavad Gita said, your mind, that self becomes the best friend of your mind. Your being becomes the best friend of your mind. It's where your mind revels. It's what your mind counts on. It's what your mind is in love with. It's where your mind rests in that ananda, which can never be touched or hurt or changed in any way. And that ananda is ever present to the spectrum of experience that we get from the whole physical world, that we get from the physical body, that we get from our sense organs, and that we get from our mind. And your mind, as you recognize this Padamam Dhamma, as the mind recognizes that, it itself calms down, because whatever foibles it may have, or whatever scars or whatever it may have, those things pale in the light of your own being. And so the mind with the personality that has developed from childhood, you know, just think about this. It's not that every Jivan Mukta means a person who really has knowledge and is living liberated, really free. Just imagine us in this room. We're all Jivan Muktas. Every one of us, say you all have knowledge, you all have nishta, really rootedness in your being, in yourself. Your knowledge is clear. You know, your mind owns your knowledge. And we're all different. Right? We're all different personalities, with different backgrounds, you know, different experiences, different sensitivities. You're not going to become not you. The upadhi will remain as the upadhi, you know, with its strengths and its sensitivities and its likes and dislikes. But they all become mitya. They all become mitya, and they've all surrendered, in a sense, surrendered to that which is surrendered in joy, in fact, in liberation, surrendered to that ananda, which is ever-present. And so that becomes what the mind loves. What the mind loves. And in that love of the source of love itself, then the relationship to this whole world is much different. It's really the relationship to Ishvara. And that means when I have that wholeness, then I can be with you. And with you, and with you, and with you. Because I don't need you to be different. You know? Nor do I want you to be different. If I want you to be different, my mind doesn't want to get into that, I'm saying like this. You give up the wanting for the world to be different. If I want, I'll do what I can to help. But if I want you to be different so I can be happy, the instant you start going there, your mind will say, don't go there. Because there's so much unhappiness in that. There's so much unhappiness. It's fine to want to help, to make a situation better. If you see something is wrong and you can make the situation better, that's human and that's natural. But that I need it to be different so I can be happy, the mind won't go along with that anymore. It'll just say, no, I don't want to go. If it goes that way, the mind will bring your mind back. Because there's only pain in that. And there's illusion in it. If I want something to be different, I can try to change it. But I don't want my ananda to be at stake. It's two different things. One is objective. This is a problem. I try to change it. My body is hurt. I try to do what I can to change it, to make it better. My mind is hurting. I have all kinds of tools and understandings to bring in to try to help. You know, I know all kinds of things. We learn all this inner child work and all of these attitudinal things and pretty picture bhavan, and all of these things are so helpful as tools to help your mind, you know, to remove the hurt that's there. But the source of the ananda is not the mind. That's the big thing. The source of the ananda is not the mind, and the ananda is ever present. So you don't have to search for it. And your mind doesn't have to be a particular way for it either. That's the huge release. And so here, and he says, Natad Bhasyate Suriha Nishashankaha Napavakaha. Nothing can and nothing will. It's not possible for any of these things to illumine this self, which is the luminary of every experience that you have. And so having gone there, having recognized that self, there's no going back because you are that. You're recognizing what you are and what you always have been. It's kind of like the space recognizing I'm not pot space. I'm space, not pot space. There's no going back from that because you're not pot space. And when you recognize your own being, there's no going back from that either. You can't not be that anymore. So once you're that, you are that. And the ananda that is different. The ananda that is your nature is different from the different vrittis that you have, what we call these ananda vrittis, or these happy vrittis that you have, or sad vrittis that you have. The nature of yourself that we call whole or complete is not the same as these joyful vrittis or happy vrittis, happy types of thoughts, compassionate thoughts, loving thoughts, joyful thoughts. Those are all fine, but they're all vrittis. Those vrittis are different than the wholeness of your own being. And then the question is, which is most important to you, these happy vrittis? You have these happy vrittis, a variety of different happy vrittis, you have these sad vrittis, and then you have you. Which one, what is it that you want? What is the most important? And as you recognize yourself, there's really no comparison between the wholeness of your own being and these varieties of happy vrittis. I don't care about these vrittis. They're nice and everything, but I really don't care at all. Or these sad ones. They have no comparison to the wholeness of yourself, and the wholeness of yourself is never away from any of these vrittis. So whatever the vritti is, you are there. And the one that is there is whole and complete. And so the mind gets tired of the samsara. As you gain knowledge, your samsara life becomes not worth it. The samsari mind becomes not something that you would choose. You choose the other. You choose the ananda of your own being, and let Ishwara be Ishwara. And let the world be what it is. And let the very nature of the world, which is subject to continual movement and continual change, go on and do its thing. Because it's going to do that anyway. You know? But you've recognized something amidst all of that that is whole and complete and is stable. And there's no going back from that, because that's the reality. And once that ignorance has been removed, then you can't get it back. That's the idea. Yeah, so let's stop. Take a moment. Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
the third experience. Did you mention that? The third experience? The three types of experiences, you said?
Yeah. The sukha. Sukha, the gradient of sukha, gradient of dukkha, and your own being. The third is your own being.
I see.
Yeah. And those three, they're ever present. The mind and the world is giving all of these varieties of experiences, and those are ever changing, but the self isn't ever changing at all. And it's aparoksha, it's absolutely present in all of them, but you need the viveka. You know, and as that viveka comes, your mind has a choice in a sense. It chooses more and more, it chooses to be rooted in you, to be, have its attachment be to you, not to these ever-changing experiences. Because you are ever-present. There's no way of losing it. So it, enjoying that wholeness, and the wholeness of yourself doesn't really compare to the flitting anandas, you know, or the flitting states that the world has to provide. So enjoying the wholeness of yourself, then you experience the world as Ishwara, really. You know, you're free to experience the world, you're free to have emotions, you're free to live. Because as you're living all the while, you are there, the stable, whole being that you are. That's the constant.
Yeah, you know, when you do a contemplation and you're with your being like that, like what you're just describing, mm-hmm. It seems very evident, but when you're with the world, it contrasted to that deep contemplation you have, it seems like.
Well, that's because you get lost out here. Your mind gets lost out here because of that lack of vairagya. Lack of vairagya is, I don't say that in any type of derogatory way, because we all have vairagya. Continues to increase, but it means that I want this to be like this, I want this to be like this, and that causes me to get engaged and my emotions to get involved. But slowly, slowly, you find yourself giving that all up because it's not worth it. It doesn't mean that you're not engaged or trying to help or trying to be, that you're involved, but your ananda is not at stake. Yeah. Then this world is not an obstacle then. It's not a problem.
It's not exactly a lack of vairagya, because when you're contemplating, you don't have that. There's no lack. There is...
That's right. When you're contemplating, all is well.
Yeah.
But what about when the world is a little tumultuous?
Tipsy-turvy?
Or going against you. Against your desires.
Oh, that's not any good.
Exactly. So that's what you start... That's what changes. That's what changes. You don't put yourself, you don't have so much attachment to the world being a particular way. You start giving that up because it's not worth it. You know, if you got something out of that, in the end, you would keep pursuing. But actually, you don't get anything out of it except pain. It's better to relax and do what you can with the situation.
So is there a technique or process you can... engage with?
I would say learn how to do mini meditations.
Mini meditations. Oh, just quit for a moment.
Mm-hmm. Bring yourself back. That's why it's very helpful to have a meditative practice, you know, because you can slow everything down and just be with yourself and remember what's true. And then you go out into the world and you get lost out there.
Right away, yeah.
But you can learn how to, you just take a moment and you learn how to bring yourself back.
Mm-hmm.
You keep doing that.
Mm.
Yeah.
How do when you spoke about the space in the pot, what was the Sanskrit word for space?
Akasha. Yeah. Okay. Gata is, you know, gata is a pot.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to know that, but yeah. Gata is the pot. And akasha is space.
And what about a desha? What does that mean?
Desha also means place. Desha is place. So I can say free from space or free from... See, kala is time. Desha is place. right? And then vastu, desha kala vastu, is objectification. So I'm not an object. I'm not something, anything that can be objectified, I'm not that. I'm not space, space or place. I'm not time. I'm not limited by a place. I'm not in this this body is in this place. This chair is in this place. This is in this place. You are in that place. For the Atma, there is no place. There's no limitation by place. So I can say I'm not limited by space. Or by place.
How's that saying go? Desha, kala, vastu.
Desha, kala, vastu, aparicheda. Paricheda means to be limited or circumscribed by something. Like I can be circumscribed by time, limited, the delimiters, you know. I was born on this day and die on this day, like that. Time limitation. Place limitation, I'm here, not there. Vastu limitation, I'm in this form, not this form. So aparicheda means to be limited by or circumscribed by. Aparicheda, you know in Sanskrit how the negates. Mm-hmm. So desha kala vastu aparicheda. Swamiji says that all the
But he says it often.
Often. So but to understand, it's important to understand, like when we have to define param or parama, supreme, that word doesn't do anything for me. So what does it mean? Say something is supreme, the supreme, the parama purusha, the supreme person. What does that mean? Limitless. It means limitless. Mm-hmm. What does limitless mean? No limitation by any type, by desha kala vastu aparicheda, that which is but has is not limited in any way.
Param.
Param or parama? Param, parama, both means. The mind is very, the mind naturally matures and gains, naturally matures in terms of vairagya as you understand it, naturally matures. But you know, it's important to, we can have notions about how our mind is supposed to be and how the body is supposed to be, how the situations are supposed to be, and those can hold you back. Because say if you say, oh, as I mature, my mind will just enjoy ananda all of the time. The only thing that enjoys ananda all of the time is yourself, is the Atma. That ananda is ever-present because it's the very swarupa, it's the very nature of being itself. So the nature of your being is what we call avyaya. It never changes from its own state. It's non-dual. It's not subject to any type of modification. Your mind, by its very nature, is changing, right? And it's got the three gunas, the sattva, rajas, and tamas. In fact, we just went through in chapter 14 these gunas. There's this one verse that says the mahatma, the jnani, is not somebody, is free of wanting one guna to be there as opposed to another. The jnani is not going to say, oh, rajas has come, you know, or tamas has come. The sattva is going, you know. They're just gunas.
Or pain has come.
Yeah. There's one thing that is aparoksha. Aparoksha means you are, your being as you are is ever present. These gunas are not covering your being. States of mind don't cover your being. Nothing covers it. The only thing that as though covers it is this aviveka, where you've not noticed the stability of yourself amidst all of these experiences. But in fact, there is no experience that covers you in any way. Not at all. Zero. It's just like clouds don't cover the sun. They cover the sun from the one looking up at the cloud. They don't cover the sun from the standpoint of the sun. Right? You can have clouds, or it can be clear, it can be whatever it is. The sun is always the sun. It's its own experience. It's not being changed at all by the clouds. And your own self-experience is never being changed by any experience that is coming through in terms of the mind or your perceptions or the physical body or whatever.
And that's distinctive to the to the individual.
That's a nature that's never will change. If that's the self of all beings, in fact, that's Ishwara. It's the nature of the self. And nothing will do ever happen. Nothing can ever do anything about that. But this, you can't stop things. You can't stop whatever's going on with your body or your mind. The dukkha that the mind, the dukkha and the suffering that the mind gets into because of samsara, because of superimposing your ananda onto the world, that goes away. You know, that's why we have the tenth man story. You know, all the to kind of understand the power of ignorance. It's like when the tenth man thinks, "Oh, the tenth man is drowned in the river, and is suffering and so worried and going, you know, about now what is going to happen, and this boy has died, and I'm responsible, and building up all of this nightmare." When the tenth man realizes, "I am the tenth man," all of this projection and all of the suffering that was caused by that goes away, right? And so, so much of the suffering of your mind, for that the mind when you were a samsari, when you didn't know yourself, and so you were searching for yourself out in the world, and it's just horrible. You know, that type of suffering goes away. Because it was rooted in ignorance, in self-ignorance. So when, it's like if you can just think, if you mistake a rope for a snake, all of your emotions are in reference to the snake. Everything you feel, everything you think is in reference to the snake until you see that it's only a rope. When you see that it's a rope, then all the whole reality that was built up around the snake experience goes away. Because now the snake is gone. Now the reality of your emotional life is in reference to the rope, right? Not to the snake. But until you saw the rope, the world was the snake world. The emotional world was the snake world, right? So it's the same here when I think that my ananda is out there to be gained, you know, then my whole life is around the gain and loss of my happiness. What about when you know that the happiness, the source of any experience of happiness, is your own being? You know, then that terrible samsara goes away, so the mind doesn't suffer that anymore. But it still has its own personality and things, the structure, its structure, mental structure that from your situation, your parents and growing up and all of that, it has certain vulnerabilities and certain strengths and all of that. That continues. But this projection goes away.
Right, when you use the rope snake analogy, could you say that that's the kind of projection that happens in psychological work, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
Which is like delusionary thinking, seeing something that's not there, or interpreting something
projection
that the person does that's not doing it at all.
Right, that's projection. In fact, Vedanta just takes projection to its ultimate, of the very nature of the self. But in psychology, we take projection for all of kind of the hurts and pains of when we were young and things that we had experienced get projected out into the world. And of course, part of maturation is the recognition of that being a projection, you know, and actually going to the source of what is really the problem. You learn how to do that. But here we're going really to the ultimate source of the very experience of ananda, which is your nature of yourself.
But you also talk about holding pain or being motherly towards it, if there is such. I mean,
where you can understand whatever the limitations of your mind are and be, and hold it in a kind way. That's a lot of the inner child work we do.
So that whole work, really, in the psychological realm, it's really more just to put the whole thing to rest.
And rest, yeah.
It's just to kind of come to the calm, relaxed, and natural state within oneself around these issues, right?
In a sense, yeah, but the reason you can do that is because you recognize the self.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to put anything to rest if there's no self.
Mm.
Right.
Self means, you know, Brahman, the Ishwar.
Right.
In the end, it all is Ishwar.
Sure.
Although the karma yoga gets you pretty close. Right?
Yes, it does. It does, and that's why karma yoga is such a sadhana, because it brings the mind into just a hair's breadth, really. Because you start treating all of your experience as Ishwar and accepting it as prasad. Really.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you the right attitude that gives the mind the space and the relaxation to allow for that knowledge to really go all the way. Karma yoga is really meant for somebody who's studying this knowledge. You know, it's very helpful for releasing you from likes and dislikes.
I mean, it's kind of the last thing to do in this world anyway. I mean,
it's the end game.
Yeah, kind of. It feels that way.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also say, you know, you can accept it part of that karma, right?
Absolutely. Accepting the power of the karma as Ishwara.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's karma yoga. And it's also jnani. Jnani accepts all of this just as Ishwara. And the only difference between the jnani and the karma yogi is the karma yogi will accept all of this as Ishwara and this is my prarabdha, but there's still some I am a jiva and this is Ishwara. But for the jnani, the whole jiva gets thrown into Ishwara. I'm Brahman. I am this whole. And that's the little shift.
The jiva is thrown into Ishwara.
You recognize the jiva itself, this body, mind, sense organs, this is all Ishwara. You know? In karma yoga, what happens is I as a jiva, this individual, have a relationship with the world, or I accept all of this as Ishwara and I take it as prasad. You know? And I can accept this life as my prarabdha. You know, and I'll accept it all with devotion to Ishwara. But there's still a little bit of that jiva-ishwara-bheda, that differentiation between the jiva and Ishwara. For the jnani recognizes the whole thing is Ishwara, that there's nothing but Ishwara, and I'm Brahman. And so that's what you're, as you go on listening, that's the shift that takes place.
Would it be possible or helpful to just kind of incorporate that into karma yoga? Like, okay, I accept all this as Ishwara, and including this jiva too.
Yeah, and that naturally happens. That's why there's, between karma yoga and jnanam, the karma yoga is not different from knowledge. Really, because everything that the karma yogi does is natural for the jnani. It's just that the ahankara is gone. The ahankara itself has become mitya. And once when a person first starts listening, the ahankara isn't mitya yet. That takes you, that you have to be exposed to this knowledge, and that mityatva, the ahankara, is something that keeps growing, so to speak, as you become clear.
And the whole time this process is going on, you're still the luminary to it all.
Yeah, always. Once you know.
Yeah.
I think at one point you just don't even have to work with a psychological level anymore. If you really, and it's almost like a different doorway. You don't need to.
You only need to work at the psychological level when it's requiring you to work on it on that level.
Yeah. When there's like in a way, you know, like pain, no?
Yeah.
In some ways. Where you might harm yourself or somebody else.
Right. If there's some pain that's disturbing for you, then you'll work with it on the appropriate level.
Mm-hmm.
Just like in the body. If there's some pain in the body that needs some attention, you'll give it the attention that it needs in an appropriate way. And it's the same if your mind has some issue that needs to be worked on a psychological level, then you do.
Mm-hmm.
But if it doesn't, then it's not there to be worked on. There's nothing, no problem.
That's a really good point. I like your distinction there. Because sometimes there is a real place to dig into the psychological stuff and to clean up one's relationship to these issues.
Yeah.
In order to actually move on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when those are there, then hopefully a part of the whole teaching is to have the tools to be able to work with the different things on their appropriate levels. It's not a statement about your knowledge. It's a statement about this issue needs to be handled in this way, and this is the best way to help.
Mm-hmm.
This is the best way to help with this particular issue, whether it's external or the physical body or in the psyche or in the unconscious or just in the mind, we understand. And so you know what to do, how to be in a way, and how to be patient.
Mm-hmm.
Patience is so important, you know. It's like what I was trying to say in the meditation, like, if you skin your knee, you can put the salve on it and everything, do and a Band-Aid, but you know what? It heals at its own pace. You can't go, oh, why aren't you even healing? You know, we don't tend to do that with the body, but you can do that with your mind. You know, as though it's supposed to race, hurry up. And really, it will go at its own pace. And our job is to create an environment where it can heal. And then let it heal. And you have to be patient. You know, it's good to learn that kind of patience, because then you can relax and let Ishwar do his job.
Well, that is his work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as much as
it is just like a plant growing. You know, the plant that grows, you know, you provide the nice environment, but the plant grows. You can't go, hurry up, hurry up.
There seems to be two workers there, though. It seems to be the jiva working on himself, and then Ishwara's projection. It all goes by his laws.
Yeah, no, I'd say the more you learn how to get out of the way of Ishwara, the better.
Mm.
You know, there's the Ishwara Srishti and Jiva Srishti. Ishwara's creation and then Jiva's projection within Ishwara's creation.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you want to do is be more in harmony with Ishwara's creation, and that means love, really. And non-attacking, ahimsa, being present to, like when Swamiji says your heart has to become as big as Ishwara. That's in reference to everything. You know, it's in reference to your own mind, it's in reference to your body, it's in reference to your own limitations, in reference to other people's limitations. And it's easy to be as big as Ishwara and to all the good things. Oh, my heart's as free as Ishwara to you because you love me and you're so good. It's my heart as big as Ishwara. We're good at the positive side of samsara. We're all jivamuktas.
But Radha, what does it come in when Swamiji says about more of Ishwara and less of you?
Yeah.
Me. Or,
yeah, more Ishwara, less of me.
Yeah,
that's
how
the
does
thing.
That come in with what you were just saying?
It's that prasada buddhi, you know?
I see, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
See, I thought it was doing prayers and so forth.
Well, prayers are beautiful also, but the prayers just are bringing Ishwara to mind. It's just a way of worshipping Ishwara. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Prayers and bhajans and all, for those that people that like that sort of thing, and rituals.
But what did you say? Could you say that again, the first one you said?
The prasada buddhi?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, where you accept everything as prasad from the Lord.
So that's more of Ishwara. That's
right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a projection.
The focus is on Ishwara, not upon you.
Yeah.
But still, like, I'm just thinking about, you know, like, the moment you know who you are, the technological world looks different because you can hold both levels in that way.
That's true, and that's why it's much easier. As your knowledge becomes clear, you become much more patient.
Yeah.
Because you're already fine.
But it's much less personal.
It's much less personal, and also there's less at stake.
Yeah.
And you always have the refuge of your own being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the natural, infinite patience of your own being. And you are fine.
Mm-hmm.
And since you are fine, you're more patient to take care of these relative problems that are there, because the wholeness of yourself is sacrosanct. That nothing will happen there.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives you the freedom to be patient with yourself and others. But, you know, learning how to be patient with yourself is important, because otherwise those parts that need to grow don't have a safe environment. And so they feel threatened internally, so they can't really grow, because there's a crabby person inside who's being mean to them. So, and just out like outside, like you say you have a child or a student or somebody, how can they grow? How can your child grow and mature, you know, and shine if they're always have a critical person? It doesn't work.
It so becomes so obvious, you know. I mean, when you have a kid, also.
Yeah, you can see.
But I mean, because it loops immediately back, because what you do to the kid in the moment of awareness, you do to yourself, and you just.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a constant feedback. I mean, you can only bypass that through ignorance, you know?
Yeah.
Be like really harmful to the child. You can only do that by being tuned out.
Because of your own pain.
Yeah.
That you don't, your own pain comes first.
Yeah.
So you use it as healing your own inner child then.
What?
If you have a child, and learn how to heal your own inner child.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's what's happening big time. I mean, I experience it totally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, totally. I mean, that's like, somebody would say, what is the most profound experience you have? That's the most profound experience.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's just even like the awareness or the love that you give, you actually feeds back to the inner child within that hasn't received that and now recognizes actually that it hasn't received that.
I think that's true. I think that Bhagavan gave us, you know, children as a healing mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to take care of our own inner child. So if you don't have any children, like I don't have any children, you find other ways to.
Yeah.
So that's the way to look at teenagers.
Take your spinach, children.
Yeah, all my little kids.
And Tibby.
Yeah.
Boy, animals are also a beautiful gift.
Mm-hmm.
Plants, animals, any living creature is beautiful. Yeah. Sodomy.
And if you treat an animal like that, that animal will respond. I mean, it knows that those dynamics are going on with it.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. It's true.